And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is our Myth of Sophia series, part 11 of 12 for 2014, as we explore the depths of myth and wisdom. I'm in studio with my co-host, Will Lynn. Welcome back to our second program in November, a little rarity. It's good to have you here after stuffing ourselves with whatever it is that we chose to stuff ourselves with for Thanksgiving. Uh-huh. Or a lot of people are referring to it now as sort of a day of gratitude, which is just as appropriate.
Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving is good. Same thing. We have an extraordinary program today with two folks who are going to share with us just some incredible wisdom, I think, from the realms of myth and wisdom, as we have in our subtitle. But before we get started, my question to you is: How is the old dissertation coming?
Short answer is I just turned in a chapter. It's going well, and I've got and I'm almost done with my second to last body chapter. It should be done this week, and I'm cruising along. Hopefully, get a draft in January 2nd.
How many chapters? How long is
six?
This?
It'll be six total.
Six total. Okay.
So just one more body chapter and a conclusion after I finish up the one I'm working on this week.
Very good. Yeah. Well, give us a little insight into. Actually, I'm going to have you hold off on giving us an insight into our guests and what we're going to talk about today, because you have some very interesting news about something that you've been working on, which may or may not tie into what we're doing here on this program.
Well, I've been hesitant to mention it because I wasn't confident enough that I'd get through, but I just finished the Harvard Business Program, the Harvard HBX Core. It's a certificate of readiness credential, basically. And it was a intensive 10 or 11 week program where we did three really focused business classes. And it was an intense boot camp for business thinking and analytics and accounting and economics. And I got a lot out of it. I've successfully passed. And I'm excited to put some of that entrepreneurial fuel to use.
Absolutely. And so let's move into our guests that we'll get to in our next segment. And just as a reminder to our listeners, the interviews that we do on this program never fit into the radio broadcast time. There's always more. I call it the afterview. If you would like to hear the entirety of these interviews, whether it be Myth of Sophia or the regular programs that I do, go to the website, richarddugan.com, go to the radio shows page, and you can listen to the entire, sometimes it's an hour, an hour and 20 minutes, whatever we record, you get to listen to. And every program is like that, including this one. So the afterview, listen to it. Our guests, Steve Gallegos and my favorite nationality, Irish. Mary Diggin are our guests, all the way from New Mexico via Skype this month or this week. Tell us just briefly where we're going to be coming from in our interview with them.
Well, the short of it is, as a program on mythology and wisdom and mythology, what they offer is an opportunity to look at the way the individual psyche can translate not just into mythology, but the other way around, how kind of inner myth has psychological value. So they develop and are working on a therapy technique that they've been doing for quite some time that helps you interact with your own inner imagination and in a way that I think will not just teach us about mythology, but I think will be valuable to people to think about their own inner selves.
Kind of like, sounds like a concept for a personal growth program, an intensive that you'd go to five nights and...
And most of those I wouldn't recommend, but this one, these guys, they really straddle both sides of the real deep spiritual, almost shamanism, and at
That's
the same
cool.
time, you know, they're PhDs. So.
Well, I'm looking forward to that and looking forward to talking with you further here on the program. And we have one more program left in the month, the year of 2014 coming up at the end of December. We'll talk about that then. Right now, we're going to take a short break and we'll hear from our astronomical and astrological assignment editor, Beth McDonald. And we'll be back with more of Tell Me Your Story, Myth of Sophia, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World.
Take a last my way.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is the Mythosophia series, part 11. I'm here with Will Lynn, and we are continuing our program here the end of November, getting into our subject matter on mythology. And Will, I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce our fine guests.
Well, we have two today, Mary Diggin and Steve Gallegos, and I'm going to just introduce them both right off the bat. So on one hand, Steve Gallegos is a former university department chair, therapist, speaker, and writer with degrees in psychology from the University of Wisconsin, New Mexico State University, and Florida State University, where he earned his PhD in psychology. On the other hand, he's a shaman, therapist, therapy trainer, who teaches the use of animal imagery to deepen one's relationship with the inner self. First and foremost, Steve considers himself a craftsman. He works in leather, wood, silver, stained glass, and most recently has begun painting Russian icons and carving fossilized walrus teeth. He maintains that had he not been required to attend school, he would be a deeply contented and illiterate craftsman. Instead, he authored two books, Animals of the Four Windows, Integrating Thinking, Sensing, Feeling, and Imagery, and The Personal Totem Pole Process, Animal Imagery, the Chakras, and Psychotherapy. He's also the honorary director of the International Institute for Visualization Research. And we're also joined by Mary Diggin, who has an MA in Mythological Studies and is a IIVR certified trainer and deep imagery guide who currently lives in New Mexico. She's born in Ireland. She moved to New Mexico in 98, and she's worked with deep imagery in the personal totem pole process for over 20 years, leading trainings and workshops as well as working with individuals. Mary completed her master's in mythological studies with an emphasis in depth psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute and is currently working on her PhD dissertation, writing on Los Hermanos de la Fraternidad Piadoso de Padre Jesús Nazareno, a.k.a. the Penitentes. Her undergraduate work was in education and religious studies, and she's also a trained masseuse, graphic and web designer, potter, writer, and sweat lodge pourer. Welcome, Steve and Mary.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Will.
I have to ask the first question, Mary.
Please do. Yeah.
Why did you leave Ireland of all places? You don't have to answer that. I love the fact that there's always an Irish connection on the program. This is exciting for me because I have been thrilled every time Will comes into the studio and we record these programs and talk about mythology, because I feel like it's something that I missed out on in school, in my education, and I would have gone a lot farther had I been exposed to them. Where are we going, Will, with these two folks?
Well, so Mary and Steve especially focus on working with internal imagery. And actually, I was wondering if either one of you would like to kind of introduce what it is that you do with internal imagery in animals.
Will, we have to begin by acknowledging the fact that there are different ways of knowing. And we, in our culture, we usually don't differentiate these very much. We focus on thinking as a way of knowing, mm-hmm. conceptualizing, ideation, and that whole realm. And this is what we train people in school, typically. That also includes mathematics. But there are other ways of knowing as well, which are older and deeper. And what we do is we work with the oldest way of knowing, which is that of the deep imagination. The deep imagination comes forth with images. And the images are alive. They're deeply alive, and their function is to align us in the totality of who we are so that we can retain our total aliveness, our centeredness, our balance. And in our present culture, since we ignore some of the ways of knowing and focus on others and concentrate on primarily on conceptualizing, and that's what we specialize in because that's what allows us to communicate with one another. But we're really the only animal that's developed that particular dimension. The other animals still retain the more ancient dimensions, as do we. But we have not necessarily abandoned them. We have lowered them on our hierarchy of appreciation. And so they need to be integrated back into thinking as well. And so what we do is we work with people at the deepest level of knowing, spontaneous knowing about their wholeness, their aliveness, their balance, their natural balance. And we help people return to the completeness of who they are. And this is what we do.
So I'm thinking about in the context of using these animals inside of us to help restore ourselves to wholeness, just by definition, if any animal you're interacting with inside yourself somehow is within yourself and part of yourself, and even if it's you know, maybe not a, I mean, people are probably very quickly going to think of like, you know, schizophrenic separate personalities and identities. And I don't think that's at all what you mean either. Maybe you could differentiate between the voices or the animals living within you and a more kind of negative schizophrenic interpretation of a fragment itself.
I think the thing is, Will, that we have a lot of different alivenesses in us.
Mm-hmm.
We think of ourselves as just being alive, period, but there are different forms of aliveness. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times these different alivenesses are not integrated. Sometimes they have no relationship with each other. And one of the things Mary and I do is we help people bring these alivenesses together into a singular whole, a singular totality, so they can all function as a unit, as a unity. And in this, they come back to maintaining a natural balance, both in their relationship to the outer world and also to the inner world. And our difficulty is, especially in Western culture, is that we have lost our connection to the deep inner world. And we have been trained to focus primarily on the outer world, on being objective and rational and mathematical. But there's also the inner world, which is governed by aliveness itself. And aliveness is a tremendous mystery and a beautiful mystery. And of course, that's where we live, although our focus is trained to be on the outer world.
Well, let's focus on that for a second and you know, do some deconstruction before we get back to building up some stuff. I think what you have to say about thinking is the primary mode of being is fascinating. I really enjoyed your comments on that in the book, in Animals of the Four Windows. And I thought one of the things that you said was particularly profound is that when we align our sensory function with our knowing or with our thinking function, then we are deluded into believing that only what we think that is backed up by what we sense can be real, which immediately invalidates what's internal, immediately invalidates anything creative or imaginal. And I was wondering if you could talk or speak to that kind of combination of the thinking and sensing world.
That's beautifully put, Will. Thank you. I think the thing is that in the Western world, we have interconnected thinking and sensing. And out of that, we've developed a particular focus on what is real. And we call this the scientific orientation, mm-hmm. which is naturally objective and rational. And there is an inner dimension as well that we tend to ignore. And the inner dimension has to do with the deep imagination and with feeling. And these are realms that we don't study in school, and we don't help people understand what they're about. And if anything, we tend to denigrate these inner realms and think of them as not as important as the outer ones.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we need all of them. We need both the inner and the outer. And this is the disconnect that's happened. This is why so many people have disconnected from their bodies. They think of the body as something objective, something that can only be studied in a laboratory. But it needs really to be experienced from the inside. And we need to live our lives from deep within who we are, all the way into the outer world. And that's where the connection has been essentially broken. And
we've kind of objectified inward instead of subjectified outward.
Nicely done, yes.
Well, now, let me ask you, aspect about this, because just recently there's I heard a program they were talking about the teaching of yoga in school, and the argument wasn't over learning yoga. The argument was over the fact that they were supposedly promoting a particular religion. And I know what yoga is, and it has nothing to do with religion. And so I have a feeling that what you're talking about is the reason why this example is the reason why we are not teaching these things, because people put religion as a label on that subject. Oh, we can't go there. We can't go there. When in fact it has so little
to do. Anything spirituality is by definition not academic and not, you know, something that's engaged in an academic environment.
Would you tend to agree that that seems to be the case specifically here in the United States?
Well, this is our problem with thinking. We label everything. We try to reduce everything to its smallest elements. But what the inner dimension does is to integrate these dimensions back into a singular totality. And this, to me, is what yoga does. It brings the body back into our aliveness and into our life as we live it.
I want to backtrack just a moment to the animals that you two spoke about inside of us. I want to know if you can share with us your perceptions, your observations of the connection between the animals that come across our paths, the physical, literal animals in the material world, and their meaning to us in terms of our inner world. Sort of like omens, if you will. I'll just use that word as an example.
Of course, omen or meaning comes back to conceptualizing. Mm-hmm. And what we really need with these animals is a relationship. So that if we meet an animal on the outside, like we have beavers here swimming up and down the Rio Grande River where we live, and the thing to do when you see a beaver is to say, hello, you have something to communicate to me. And to allow the communication to take place in a place where we can hear it through the imagination, not through our ears necessarily, but through the imagination. So that the deep imagination is the place where we connect with animals, where they connect with each other, and also the realm of feeling is where they connect. They don't think about their relationships. They just enter into them, jump into them, and they are there in the immediacy of their relationships. Once we start making a meaning, and of course this is our human bent to put meaning on everything that we encounter. Once we start translating things into meaning, we divorce ourselves to some extent, at least from the spontaneous aliveness that's naturally there in who we are. And in who we were when we were born. When we were born, we were spontaneously alive. We didn't have too much that we could do because we weren't very developed. We could feel, we could cry, we could smile, we could reach out for certain things. We learned to crawl eventually. And then after we were a few years old, meaning started being introduced into our lives, and we were expected to translate everything into meaning rather than trusting the knowing that was there in our fundamental aliveness. Aliveness itself has a very natural authority, and we can see this in all wild animals. Every wild animal has its natural authority of its own aliveness. It doesn't have to be learned in any way. It's just naturally, spontaneously there. Our difficulty in translating everything into meaning means that we are translating. That is, we're trying to plug things into a linguistic and conceptual realm rather than allowing that to be one facet, perhaps, of what we're doing, but not to be the controlling dimension of our presence here.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think, one of the I feel like we'll have a lot of, you know, chance to keep talking about this at an academic level. And, you know, you have PhD in psychology and a practicing therapist. But at the same time, this also really sounds like the kind of thing I might hear from, you know, a shaman thousands of years ago describing his relationship with animals, describing his living, interactive, spiritual life that in which animals participate. To what extent do you associate what you're doing with the inner work, which we'll get into more specifically and how it works in a moment, but to what extent do you associate it with not just Native American shamanism, but any shamanism?
I think shamanism is kind of a cultural orientation. Mm-hmm. And what we need today in our Western world is a full integration of our outer knowing and our inner knowing. And we've divorced ourselves fundamentally from our inner knowing and not given it nearly as much attention as it needs. We don't respect it as much. We tend to put imagination into a realm of make-believe rather than a realm that has its own function within who we are. And for me, that function is helping us come back to our wholeness, to our balance, and to the fullness of our deep aliveness. And within that, there is a natural knowing that's spontaneous, that's immediate, and that's present in every moment. One of our difficulties is that we string ourselves out in time. And time is a nice conceptual dimension, but it takes us away from the aliveness of our present moment. And I think this is what shamans always try to do. They try to bring the person back into the present moment of their aliveness so that they could experience fully what it was they needed to experience in order to go through this passageway of illness or divorce or loss of soul or whatever they did call it. It's a passageway back to the totality of who we are. And what we've done in the Western world is we've focused primarily on translating and relating the smaller parts, the identifiable parts, to each other in kind of a mathematical precision rather than in terms of a dynamic aliveness that's spontaneously there.
Mm-hmm. You've got this great, great quote I'd like to read from the book. It says, "The new man will not be a scientist who rejects feeling and imagery, nor a shaman who rejects science, but a whole man who lives in the full complexity of his being." And I'm really hoping that, I know it's going to take us our full time for it to really come through. Your work, I mean, one of the things I'm excited about is I know I can ask you the hard questions that I couldn't ask a lot of maybe a lot of people teaching image work, because your work stands up on both sides as a, you know, on the side of science, you know, really working with this with an understanding of what wouldn't be received well by science, but at the same time, really digging right into the inner being as a shaman would. And so, I wanted to read that line because I think it offers the balance that I think your whole project is going for between shamanism and scientific psychology.
Yes, and that speaks also to the question that you asked earlier about hallucination and psychosis and things like that. And mm-hmm. in those situations, people live the inner, but they're disconnected from the outer.
Hmm.
We unfortunately try to live the outer with a disconnection from the inner. And maybe we're equally as crazy, but it doesn't seem as such because the outer is so accepted as the social dimension in today's age. And what we need in both cases is the full integration of the inner and the outer with each other.
Let me ask you in regards to science and mysticism, shamanism, whatever phrase term you want to put to it. Science over the years, especially in the latter part of the 20th century, has been able to verify the existence of certain aspects or attributes of the inner world. Not all of them, certainly. We've dealt with death and dying, or as I like to call it, transitioning, and there's still a lot of skepticism as to near-death experiences by people, and it's just the brain's firing off this, that, and the other thing. But there are other aspects that they're able to support. Do you see that science and the spiritual world are sort of coming together more so? In this is what's referred to as that new man that Will was referring to from the quote?
I think it is coming together. The difficulty we have in approaching it scientifically is that we want to approach the inner from the outer.
Ah. Yeah,
and, right.
And right. That's a problem right there.
Mm.
And what we need to do is recognize that experiencing is different from thinking, is different from conceptualizing. And so if we can come back to the immediacy of our experiencing, and then out of that, we allow our conceptualizing and our thinking and our broad speculation to emanate, that's something else. Then there's the full integration, but from the inside to the outside. I don't think we'll ever reach the inside from the outside. We can measure it.
Mm-hmm.
We can conceptualize it in different ways. But the experiencing is essentially, I think, what all shamans were about to begin with. And also what we need to be about is living our aliveness from the inside outward.
Now, it's interesting that you say that because when I was working years ago for a Christian radio station, and I was also introduced to Eastern philosophy, and especially the word metaphysics, and I looked up the definition in Webster's, and I found out it's beyond the physical. And I, of course, read from cover to cover the Bible. I thought, interesting. Christianity is a metaphysical religion. But nobody would agree with me on that because they always wanted to make it an external experience.
Right.
And yet, as I
there's
would—
There's no meta there.
Yeah, there's no meta there. And so when I would take my Strong's Concordance and I would look up certain passages and I would look up certain words, every single time— it was about an internal experience, whether you spoke of the rapture, whether you spoke of the return of the Messiah or the Christed One, or whether you spoke of heaven and hell. It was all internal.
No kind of behavioristic account of just purely external mechanical motion.
Even in the Old Testament, the devil, as you research it, is not a literal physical being. It's the lower base nature of man, which guess where that is? Inside.
So I actually want to take this opportunity to angle a question at Mary. I was recently reading some of your work, and I read one of your essays where you engage Nietzsche's famous statement that God is dead, and you describe it as an echo of a much earlier statement that Pan is dead, and you bring into context the conversation that our kind of our cultural religions are maybe don't hold as much potency for as many people as they used to. And I was wondering, you know, some of this work that that Steve and you are doing on it's very personal. It deals with your own inner relationship with your own spirituality, and this is something that, you know, Campbell talks about from a mythological point of view, kind of developing your own mythical life, and we've heard a number of people talk about developing your own personal relationship on a religious or spiritual level, but what this practice that you guys are describing offers is a really, really profound opportunity to do that. And I was wondering if Mary, if you could talk to the way that you feel this work is reacting to the world today, right now.
Well, I think it's back to this, the fact that, well, I think you've covered some of this already in talking about the idea of the metaphysical. And I mean, the big problem, I think, in Western religion is that we literalize. You know, we take what's written in the Bible, as we've already mentioned, the Bible, we take that as literal external happenings. Mm-hmm. And there's a great suspicion of the internal unless it's actually really culturally approved. Mm-hmm. Now, that's, I think, not unusual in cultures. We want our culturally approved inner experiences. But when you get a very predominantly strong literalization of something like, I think, which has happened with Christianity in many, many ways. It's like they're trying to be scientific about it. You know, they're trying to make this into the sensate world and the thinking world. And the truth is our inner experience, there are no rules there. Our inner experience, firstly, doesn't follow the rules of the sensate thinking.
I can fly in there.
Junction,
I can fly.
You can fly. You can merge with an animal. You can have the experience of being eagle. Mm-hmm. You can have the experience of being mouse. You can have the experience of being worm, you know? It's an experiential thing. It's an experience you go through that the deep imagination allows you have. Now, in our culture, the experiences we're allowed in what we would call spiritual or religious fields have been extremely narrowed. Mm-hmm. And even narrowed enough that you would be regarded beyond perhaps someone being able to say, oh, I'm speaking to Jesus. There's very little outside of that that in the Christian culture is approved, at least. And I think as religions tend to move towards what could be called more a fundamentalist attitude, they tend to literalize. Mm-hmm. And they tend to narrow the experience. So the only thing allowed is, which is interesting, the only thing that's allowed is usually what's in writing.
Right.
You know, and writing has already translated someone else's experience into a written thing. And I don't think it's meant to be prescriptive.
Right.
You know, I mean, Barbara Hannah wrote that Jung, you know, when you talk about Jungian stuff, like Jung kind of said, thank God I'm young and not a Jungian. And I'm always, my feeling on that one is that what Jung was saying is you need to do what I did. You need to go in there and you need to experience what's happening for yourself. And you see that in, say, the Red Book. And you see the layers he went through of experiencing and then thinking about the experience and all of that. And what we do is we jump to maybe the third or fourth level of what has been done, which is the writing part of it, where mm-hmm. someone has said, oh, this is it, this is my understanding of it. So there's a lot more in there, and it's moved away from the direct experience. And I think inner life is a direct experience.
A couple things to dovetail off of what you've said. Number one, my observations regarding translation, not only of someone else's observations or perceptions, but of their observations and perceptions written in a language we don't speak. So now it has to be translated. Then yes. we lose mm-hmm. a lot in the translation. So we really don't know what that individual yeah. was mm-hmm. really saying.
And just think about how much, have you ever written down a dream? How much of that dream do you really get written down, even when you feel like you write down the whole thing? You can't convey the whole experience.
Exactly. The other aspect of it, too, has to do with, obviously, experience, and mine, as far as other people and sharing their experiences that don't appear between the covers of whatever the book is that they're following,
yeah.
is who am I to pass judgment on your experiences? I don't mm-hmm. care if it's not in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. It was your experience. Share it with me.
Yeah, when is something written down about something that happened way long ago treated as more real than an experience here and now?
Yeah.
And that was one of the big things that Jeff was talking about when he came on the show, and he was saying, like, if we can't deal with people having alien abduction experiences and put those into the context of the very popular alien mythology, how can we talk about, you know, an ancient religion and then deny the actual experiences that made that religion living when it first came to yeah. be? We have a tendency to want to objectify and ossify everything, whether it's religion, science, doesn't matter. You know, we want to turn ourselves into robots so we don't have to make decisions, and we can just, you know.
And we also tend to want to make things canonical. You know, we want the right thing.
Everybody can agree now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's back to our objectifying, our tendency to objectify.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, you know, experience is a little scary because it happens once, you know, you've experienced it.
Yeah.
So if you keep going back to that, well, you'll experience something different the next time.
Exactly.
You know, so I had an experience recently, there I'm using the word, but I was in leading a workshop and we were doing the chakra animals. And at the end, the last final journey, one woman said to me, oh, she said, well, there was a different animals in the chakras this time round, and I don't know if I believe in this. And I and I said to her, yes, but you have changed over the weekend. Uh-huh. Things have changed for you.
Yeah.
And it was like a light went on in her. Because the uncertainty was about her affinity, and I think our general affinity in the world, to certainty, to stability, mm-hmm. to things remaining the same, when in fact we change all the time.
There's a great quote that I would assert to a certainty, and that is that it is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than to begin in certainty and end in doubt.
I like that.
And I remember sharing with my sister, my oldest sister, many years ago around the holidays, we were standing in the kitchen chatting, and she was of a very rigid belief system. And
this is a good Thanksgiving line, people. Take this home.
It really is. Really. We got into a little row, and my mother said, get out. Basically, my comment to her was, because she was challenging where I was spiritually, I said, look, my beliefs of yesterday are not my beliefs of today, are not my beliefs of tomorrow, which could even be applied to knowing as well, because I'm constantly experiencing and learning and growing and observing. And so how is it possible? How is it even logical that one could have the same beliefs? And that's, to me, extremely important for each one of us to try to remember, is that because we're constantly moving and growing and changing, Everything about us is moving and growing and changing.
And instead of being afraid of that as though it threatens a sense of identity and stability, if you engage it, then you can actually grow and change fast and a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's actually, Mary and Steve, I think this is a good time to kind of see if you guys can describe for us more specifically what this process is like and what it's about. So if you were to lead or try and introduce somebody or help somebody find their animals for the first time, what would that be like?
First of all, you have to recognize, where is the person right now? Where is their awareness? Mm-hmm. What are they focused on? And that could be a starting point, or it could be that you need to help them come back to a different place in who they are for the beginning. That is, I worked once with a man who had just come in from going out and looking at a lot of different properties in Boston. And his mind was full of the properties and prices and things like this. And there was no way he could plunge into his imagination because mm-hmm. he was too focused on the thing that he'd been doing. So sometimes you need to help bring a person down from the place where they typically are. And usually, being Westerners, we usually are in our thinking. Mm-hmm. And when I work with people, they might start out by thinking, oh, I'm afraid I can't do this. And what if nothing happens? And, you know, I've never done this before, so I have my doubts about it. So there's all kinds of thoughts going around there. Mm-hmm.
Very interfering thoughts. I can imagine my hyperactive mind would be very interfering.
So first of all, you need to give them room for those thoughts and let them just make room for the thoughts so they can be there without fighting them and without trying to stop the thoughts. But room also for much more. Help them come then into some feeling, into the experience of their breathing, into being supported there wherever they are, whether in a chair or lying on a mat or in a bed, and come into other experiences, and then you can bring them down into the experience of the imagination. I mean, the experience of the imagination is very deep. And at that point then, you can say to them, focus your attention in your heart and ask if there's an animal that can come to you in your imagination from your heart. And they're always surprised because immediately there's an animal there. Right. Now, it may not be an animal that they wanted. What if it's a little mouse that's shivering with fear? And they say, oh, my God, there's a mouse here, but I'd like to have a lion, and I want to be lion-hearted. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is how we live our lives in terms of wanting to be other than how we
right.
are. And we have to start with where we are. That's the only starting point we can have.
And it's actually hard to lie to yourself. You kind of know when you're doing it.
mm-hmm. Yeah. And what you have to do is help them be content with the mouse and say to the mouse, oh, I didn't want you. I see you're shivering, and I'd rather have a lion there, but here you are. How do we need to communicate? And the mouse might say to the person, I've been terrified all my life, you know. Certainly it'd be nice to have a lion here to protect me, but I'm just scared. And then you can say, "What? When did you first get scared? How did that happen? How did that begin?" And then the mouse may recount a situation where there was tremendous threat. And it may be a situation that's been long forgotten. And you can always have them ask the mouse, is there something here that's ready to heal? And the healing is very available when you work with the deep imagination. Mm-hmm. That is one of its functions, to help us heal. Mm-hmm. And it helps us heal in numerous ways, emotionally, spiritually, even physically. And so we enter there and help the person develop a dialogue with whatever appears to them, whether it's a mouse or a lion, and to begin a relationship. And the relationship is what is vital. That is what's important. It's not a matter of controlling the animal or of being controlled by the animal, but of developing a relationship. And of course, this is then tantamount to a relationship between our thinking and our deep imagination. Mm-hmm. And that's where the rift has occurred, usually when we were children, when we learned to say, oh, this is just my imagination, so it's not important. Or, oh, I'm just making this up. I don't know where it comes from. Or, wow, I have these things happening in my imagination and I'm scared. There's a dragon under my bed, you know. And Papa comes in and says, look, come on, I'll show you there's no dragon there, and so on. So we tend to reduce the importance of the experience of knowing through feeling and through the deep imagination. And we need to help that then come back into being a participant in the presence of who the person is.
And so I was really moved by a particular story you gave of a person who had kind of very happy animals that were associated with all of his different things that you asked him to associate with. And then when you got to the thinking and to the brain, he had the octopus that was trying to hold on to everything and manage everything. And all the other animals were carefree and easy because they weren't tasked with any responsibilities. And when this patient finally got to a point of talking to the octopus, and the octopus learned that he actually doesn't have to be the one responsible for all the functions of the self, it's a huge relief and release. And I think that's this place where a lot of our culture is in, where we have functions of ourself that can, you know, pull some weight. And sure would be nice if we let it.
I think the thing is, Will, that we've tried to get our thinking to do everything.
Right.
Our thinking has learned to think it's supposed to be in charge, and it's not.
Right.
Our thinking is primarily supposed to be a storyteller, something that comes along and that summates everything and brings things together into a beautiful story, whether it's a mythological story or a contemporary story, and pulls things together and gives room for everything that's there, rather than being the determinator or the controller. And one of the things we've gotten lost in, and to me this is a tremendous illness, is being so involved with control and obedience.
Absolutely.
If you look at our schools, this is primarily what they teach: control and obedience.
Mm-hmm.
Once we develop that dimension within who we are, then one part of us wants to take control and thinks the rest of us should be obedient.
You're trained in behaviorism. You know what the effects are when you when you do that in a school.
Well, and I have to
Mary,
say,
you're laughing back there.
I have
you guys
to,
talk about this before?
And I have to say that I find it really interesting that when I was in school so many years ago, I was taught, and I think this was probably in biology class, that boys and girls learned differently. Now, this is going back to the late 60s and 70s. And so I'm sitting there, oh, yeah, okay, I'm a little energetic and hyperactive mm-hmm. as a boy, and the girls, they can sit still for longer periods of time and they learn. And I have to say that I was so glad that I got out of school when I did, because as soon as I got out of school, I started hearing about how they were giving kids Ritalin to normalize them.
I'm right.
going, but you just told me back
right.
there
that
boys
are
and
like
girls,
that.
And the girls are like that, and that they're different. Why are you trying to normalize them?
Right.
It just was so perplexing to me.
I think we run into a lot of that.
Well,
where there are ideas about who the student should be rather than really getting to know who is this kid.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And religion does the same thing, but they don't use drugs of a chemical nature. They use them of a, again, this goes back to that whole controlling mm-hmm. issue that, you know, if you don't believe this way, you're right. going to suffer the consequences.
Right.
And I always thought, wait a minute. I believe in law enforcement, they refer to that as extortion, don't they?
Yeah.
Isn't there a law against that?
Right.
Am I wrong or I don't know?
Our souls are held hostage for our belief in God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You
well,
know?
Okay. So the other thing I want to get into is you're starting to describe some of these interactions of animals, inner animals. What immediately becomes clear is that these conversations start to sound like fairy tales. You know, they start to sound like the interaction of animals in a very psychological level. And this is one I wanted to angle at Mary, because Mary, in her background with Irish studies, is spent some time looking at Irish other worlds, which are a little different than some other mythological traditions, where the other worlds are far and distant. In the Irish tradition, you can just slip right in. So, Mary, what do you see a real relationship between the kind of almost maybe personal mythology that can develop in these practices, and in the stories that we read?
I do, and I think partially because many of those stories are they're about experiences people have had, and especially if you look at the Irish tales, and more maybe the folk tales than necessarily the serious mythologies. But mm-hmm. although the serious mythology, I mean, the first thing I think you learn from Irish mythology is that, you know, the land predates you. You have to come and have an experience, and you have to build a relationship with the land. So you've all that whole book, what we call in English, the Book of Invasions, and people coming to it. But there is that primary thing of, you know, humans are visitors almost. You know that humans have to build a relationship with the other in order to stay on this particular land.
Mary Black has a great line in a song called "You Don't Own the Land Owns You."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's primarily a very Irish idea that the land predates us. The land is before us in some way. And the only way, the Milesians, who would have been the last set of people, get to stay on that land is that they get a promise of the goddess, the Two of the Donnan, who then go into the land. I mean, there's battles and stuff, but they eventually go into the land, and you have this idea of there's a relationship. So many of the, and that's where our idea of, say, the underworld, although in Irish myth, it's much more the other world than the underworld, because under gives you that sense of downward direction, while in Irish myth, it's a horizontal thing. So it's that idea that we do slip in and out of these places, and you get, you know, very interesting stories like Turlough O'Carolan, who was a very famous harper in the 1600s, or maybe the 16th century, might have been the 1500s, who was a blind harper, but he would say he got his music from the fairies. Hmm. And there's a pile of folk stories of people entering the hills or entering the fairyland, and they come back usually with gifts. And I think for me, that is a very apt metaphor for our experience of working with the deep imagination.
The value of going in there.
The value of going in there. And it isn't, you know, the other side of fairy tales is our culture, of course, has been, you know, we're used to the grim version of, you know, fairies and easygoing stuff. And the fairy tales usually aren't that scary. Although Steve sent me, and I mean, we know this from other researches, of course, fairy tales were never all, or were not always about sweet and light and good happenings. Mm-hmm. And there was some interesting stuff that Steve and I were looking at last week, where, you know, when they're going back into some of the original versions of the stories rather than the later grim editions of the stories. And the truth is, when you go into the imagination, the aim in deep imagery, I mean, the aim of the imagination or the tendency is to pull you towards your wholeness. And sometimes you do have to meet places in yourself that are scary or sad or angry. Mm-hmm. And in fairy tales, those are very true. You know, this is what happens. You do meet those. And I do think that traditions where we still have... It's like the stories of the cultural stories keep the doorway open so that you don't close down your own experience. I don't necessarily, I think people like Turlough and Carolan and those did have certain experiences, but by maintaining those stories and the culture, it's not that they're saying this is what your imagination is like when you go in there.
Right.
And particularly the Celtic stuff, because there's a myriad of ways of entering it. There's a myriad of experiences in it. There are so many different happenings and different descriptions of the world. It's almost like the Celtic or the Irish mythology, at least, didn't decide there was only one canonical version of this.
Right.
It left enough space that you could have your own experience, and therefore it wasn't closing the window down too much, that it didn't say, oh, if you have something like this, there's no room for it. No, there's so much room. There's so many different variations. Culturally, I think having those type of stories still being told, still being some way alive in the culture, that they're almost like the cultural permission or to have our own experiences of imagery. Especially as you have in the Irish stories of so many different variations on the underworld or other world, that there's no possible way of saying any one experience is right or wrong.
Right.
Just as a reminder, you're listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is our Mythosophia series, and we have Mary Diggin and also Steve Galagos on our line here all the way from New Mexico, and we're talking about mythology. I find it interesting, too, both Steve and Mary, in terms of mythology. We've all heard this phrase before when people talk about some of the fantastic stories that we might hear, and they're not even saying, oh, this is myth. But that in all mythical stories, there is a certain level of truth. Is that a fair statement as far as you're concerned?
And let me actually, I really like your question, and I want to cherry pick and add an edge to it. Same thing, you know, when you have an animal come into your mind, you know, what level is that true versus a falsity?
Well, if you're, I mean, we're kind of back to what you mean by truth. I mean, if you're going to confine truth to the sensate thinking world, then you are going to have issues with myth and with imagery and with all of that. But if your sense of truth is not confined to that, and I mean, do you mean true? Do you mean real? Well, you know, there's a whole range of permutations in there. So if you're in imagery and you're in your deep imagination, of course it's true. I mean, it's an experience of you. I mean, it's a thing you are experiencing. And the experiences in imagery are as real as the experiences you have in everyday life.
It's just instead of grounding it in an objective world, the truth is grounded and it's true for you. You are having that.
All right, but I'm going to expand that a little bit then. All right. Okay. All right, can we use that same explanation when talking about Roman or Greek mythology, Aesop's fables as a mythological story, or as we've talked on a number of programs on Mythosophia over this year, Star Trek Next Generation mm-hmm. is our modern day mythology. Do your same rules, if I can put that on there, do they still apply to those considerations?
I don't know if I'd say they're rules. It's that the experience you're having is the experience you're having.
Okay.
And if you're going to talk about, you know, of course the stories have a truth in them. They might tell you about the human condition. They might tell you, you know, they might point out the extremes of what we do as humanity, or they might just be a doorway for you. So if you tell a story, it's one of the things I often do. I think it was one of my standard workshop types is to take any story, take a myth, take a story that's important to people or one that's interesting, or take something like the mother, maiden, crone idea and journey into it.
Mm-hmm.
Take it and see, tell the story. And then see, guide a journey, and let's see what a guide brings someone to. And that's the way I think of discovering your own personal, if you want to say truth, I mean, I'm not that comfortable with that word, but if you want to say truth, your own personal interaction, your own personal doorway into the story. And it may take you to somewhere that is not in the story that's been told. It's an experience entirely yours.
Right.
And I think we don't allow too much that sort of imaginative interaction with story. And you certainly don't have it. I mean, I was brought up in the Catholic Church, so when someone they read the stories firstly and from the Bible, and then they told you what they meant.
Right.
So, you know, it's the same thing I think that happens a lot with other types of stories too, that someone interprets them for you. But what if in that moment you can actually go into the story yourself? What if you can open it up? What if you're if you have your imagination open and you have you can approach a guide to say, well, where do I need to go in the story?
And what the problem is that we don't trust that. Is that when we do that, we think that, okay, well, whatever answer we give, it's going to be an answer from me. It's not going to be, you know, the answer from God or something like that. It's, you know, how do I trust it? But then I think that, you know, the more I've read through the book and the more I'm, you know, kind of massaged into what you guys are doing, the more I feel like if you just do it, if you just start doing it, the process will come alive more and more, become more and more natural. And even before it does, but especially as it does, the value is going to be self-defining and obvious. And whatever comes out of you, there's reason it's there.
Yeah.
And if you say, you know, Jung asked this great question. He says, okay, well, if we're throwing out all these mythologies as fairy tales, we'll throw them out as fairy tales for a while as scientists. But at some point, as scientists even, we're going to ask, well, if it wasn't objectively true, then still, why? You know, and yeah. I think we got to ask the same thing. If there's no God or objective truth to the animals or something in our hearts, there is deep meaning and value and reason that we can get by using that as a starting point for therapy.
And I know that Will has probably kind of answered this question. I have a question for you, Mary, regarding story, and I have a shamanic question for Steve, which I'll get to in a moment. But in terms of this issue of stories, or we'll use the term story in a more broad sense. From your perspective, Mary, why is story important?
I think we tell stories. I think we tell stories all the time, you know.
Yes.
And so for the human beings, or Steve had a phrase that we are the storytelling animals. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked that because I think that's what we do. And we tell stories about ourselves. What happened today? We start telling you a story. And I think there's a place where narrative allows us create a plot in which we are part of this plot. And it gives at some level an explanation or a meaning, or it allows us to explore something. But it's a second or third step beyond the experience we've had. Mm-hmm. So it gives us a chance to form it. And I know that, you know, if we're talking about storytelling, and often I think we get stuck in a particular story. We tell a certain story about ourselves, and that's what we get stuck in.
Oh, you had that time where you notice, man, I tell this story about myself every time. Oh, and then it's like, man, you start telling new stories after that, thank God.
Yeah, or else you keep telling the same story, and it's like different. It's the same. It's this, basically the same story. You might have different happenings in it, but you're still coming out with the same end result.
I do the same thing on this program because I'll share my experiences of my early days in broadcasting, and I'll go through, and sometimes it's really long. And then I'm listening to the programs after we're going, I really need to shorten that sucker up. And so the next time I tell it, I'll make it briefer and briefer and briefer. And then there are times when I'll just touch upon. Yeah, I worked for this station, and then I'll get into what we were talking about as far as the subject matter, because it's like the listeners. Now, the guest has never heard it before, but the listeners who are regulars, it's like, oh, my God, he's going to tell that again. Oh, Lordy.
Isn't that interesting in and of itself that we do tell the story?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And stories are important to us. I think the mistake we make is to actually think they're, what would I say, to actually feel that we have to keep to the single story in some way.
Right. If we break our narrative, will we be ourselves? Is this kind of a buried question?
Yeah. I'd like to ask Steve a shamanic question in regards to being a shaman. Why and how did you become a shaman?
First of all, I'm not a shaman. I don't consider myself a shaman.
I said that.
So this is on Will.
But I think it's a fair comparison, and I'm looking forward to your answer.
If I would consider myself anything, it's a researcher.
Okay.
I'm fascinated by research. And in fact, my first PhD was in experimental psychology. And then I did a 2-year residency in psychotherapy. And I became very interested in the inner as opposed to the outer, because I felt that the method of scientism that we have today eliminates the inner before we even begin. Mm-hmm. I was taught that the inner is like a black box. Of course, this was purely behavioristic at that time. You can tell how old I am from that.
Hey, they still teach it as the primary foundation of psychology at my undergrad.
Uh-huh.
But I'll complain about that off the air.
Well, so go ahead.
Little by little, I got interested in the inner and realized that that really is what the students, when I was a professor, what they were seeking was knowledge about the inner, and yet we were only teaching them about the outer and about pigeons and rats and all of these kinds of things, but nothing about themselves, the inner lives of who they were. And I didn't know how to approach that, and so I left and studied to become a psychotherapist, and that's when these animals came to me just spontaneously, and they started teaching me. They taught me what they knew about me, which was much more than I knew about myself. And then I realized they're the real teachers. They are the real therapists. And if I have any kind of a job, it's to help people meet this dimension within themselves. Mm. And so I began to do that. And that has just taken me totally in a whole different direction in myself and in my life and out into the world as well. Mm. And I love deeply what I do right now because there is no, what could I say, there is no controlling interface there. I don't have to go through an administration of a university to teach what I teach. Mm-hmm. I contract directly with the people that come to me to learn.
Mm.
And so we're just there one-to-one. And we don't have to be approved by an administrator of any sort or a...
You mean you don't have to start your inward journey by getting everything cleared with the outward forces?
Exactly. And I don't have to sign grades or anything like that. And I don't have a registrar telling me it's time to get your grades in,
right.
Dr. Gallegos.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's one line you said. I wanted to make a quick connection to the Kung Fu Shaolin use of animals. And as I understand it, part of the reason that they use animals is not just for the fighting styles, but because by putting their psyche into an animal, it enables them to disidentify with their typical self that comes with all of its insecurities and hesitations and everything else. So while in one way it's to take on the energy of the animal, it's also to create a kind of a second self that doesn't have the typical inhibitions of the first self. And I'm wondering to what extent do you think that working with animals and helping people to find the animals inside are also helping them to find voices of their own voices that are typically drowned out by the more dominant central psyche with its insecurities and readings.
What I would say is, rather than just finding voices, they're finding alivenesses,
mm-hmm.
deeper and deeper alivenesses within themselves, and these alivenesses already know. And this is why for somebody doing martial arts can step into an animal and step into the knowing of that animal mm-hmm. in how it would be there in a fight or in a contest with another animal or with a human being, because that's what they're doing. And so the knowing is already there, and we're born with this knowing, and we're born with these various alivenesses. Each one knows a certain thing. And this is what I found when I first started working with people with the chakra animals. These were people who lived primarily on farms. They were very fundamental people, people of the earth. They were very unsophisticated psychologically, and yet their solar plexus animal knew exactly what it was there to do. Their belly animal knew exactly what it was there to do. The heart animal knew what it was there to do in a much better sense than they themselves knew. And so you had immediately stretched out this tremendous variety of alivenesses there, each one with its own knowing and its own relationship with the world. Mm-hmm. And of course, the trouble with these people is they had learned to confine themselves mm-hmm. to a particular story that could be approached and judged, we could say, by other people in their community. And this is, of course, what we do. Mm. We build a facade or a gestalt that can be approved by others.
A whole belief system.
Yes, and this is our difficulty with truth, because truth for us has become something that can be socially validated.
Mm.
That is, has to be validated by someone else.
If people don't read my dissertation, I must not have made any sense.
And in the work that I do, most people start out by saying, you know, there's no room for me here. I have to give the room up to the group rather than mm-hmm. taking the room that I need to go into myself and discover who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do that, when they allow themselves that discovery, they come to this unique being that they are, that is there without comparison, that is incomparable to anyone else. And then they could start appreciating and trusting the person that they were born to be.
Exactly. Well, I hate to cut you off, but we're just about out of time, and I want to thank both of you for joining us here on the program. This has just been extraordinary, and I thank you both for sharing this hour with us. It's been fabulous.
Totally amazing talking to the two of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Thank you, Richard.
I still have three questions that I'm going to ask each of you in turn, and I'm going to try to do it in such a way as to not allow you either to have a lot of time to think about it, and that's the intent. So I'll start with Mary and ask, who is Mary Diggin?
Mary Diggin is changing every moment. So there's no kind of set story about me right now, but I am someone who right now appreciates being alive and appreciates what's been going on for the last hour or so and really, really loves what I've been doing.
Who is Steve Gallegos?
he's a curious guy who never understood himself because he was always told that he was crazy. And so he needed to find out why he was crazy and how he came to be crazy. Since then, he's discovered that he is so beautifully complex and deep that there's no way of really ever knowing finally who he is. But he's had the fascinating experience of discovering through DNA analysis that the person who grew up thinking he had a Spanish heritage was actually an Indian.
Oh, and wow.
He discovered that only a couple of years ago. So it's like the story that he had carried about who he is had to be totally
right.
let go of and dissolved, and him begin to discover then, wow, who is this guy anyway?
I like the fact that you talk about yourself in the third person. That's very cool. Second question, Steve, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
What I love to do is to watch people grow and heal and come back to their own wholeness and to the deep trust of who they are. And this is what I do, and I love doing that, and there's nothing I would rather be doing right now.
And Mary, what do you hope to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I hope to... My big interest is in restoring sort of a what you'd call a healing sensibility to culture. I want our cultures, I want the places we live in and the societies we live in to open the doorways again to know that healing is possible in the world so that people do get that chance, that they're not being, it's not being cut off before they ever open their eyes to this world, but that they do have that story is told in the culture that, yes, you can go and you can heal and that you can grow and that you can be who you are and that there's room here in this world for you to be who you are. And that usually means that you need to find the person, the human being needs to find the courage and the space and that doorway to go into themselves to find out that who they are and how that is. And I think some of it is closed off to us because of the way our culture operates.
And who inspires you, Mary?
Steve, for sure. But also so many of the people I meet. I think doing this work has allowed me, it's not just that I meet the people, but I witness people. I witness how they grow and change. So I'm deeply inspired by the imagery work. I'm also very, very inspired. Steve has been a great teacher in my life. So has a Hickory Apache medicine man that I apprenticed with, Felipe Ortega. And so indeed have many of the people who were at Pacifica Graduate Institute, who I just have finished my three-year program there. And I have been, feel I've been gifted by meeting those people and by doing what they do.
And Steve, who inspires you?
The entire universe inspires me. It's brought me here. I've gone through this very brief path, and I'll be returning to the universe soon, and I'm fascinated by the entire journey.
Steve Gallegos, Mary Diggin, I thank you so much, both of you, for joining us here on Tell Me Your Story, Mythosophia series, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom with Will Lynn and I. And I extend an invitation to both of you, if you find yourselves in the Southern California area, Santa Barbara, Central Coast area, we would love to have either or both of you in studio to continue this conversation. This, to me, is extraordinary and fascinating, and I love it.
Thanks for joining
us. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Will.
And Will, thank you for sharing this time with us. I'm Richard Dugan, and we'll find out about Will's dissertation next month. Until next month at this same time, love Talal.